Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources for April 17th, 2003. Welcome to all of you. We are not going to hear three bills today, so if you're here for those bills, I will tell you which ones they are. House Bill 3269 we will not hear today. We will not hear House Bill 3270 today, and we will not hear House Bill 3552. Those bills will be carried over to Tuesday of next week. But we are going to hear everything else on the list today. And before we get started, as normal, I want to make you all aware that if you are a government official or a lobbyist, when you sign the witness registration sheet, you are acknowledging that your testimony must be in accordance with two Oregon statutes that govern accurate and truthful testimony. If you are a member of the public, this does not apply to you. However, of course, we still want your testimony to be accurate and truthful. So, having said that, thank you all again for coming today. We're going to begin a work session and public hearing on House Bill 2769. Representative Prozanski, come forward, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and colleagues and committee members. What you have before you, House Bill 2769, would provide for the state of Oregon permitting farmers to grow industrial hemp in the state of Oregon. The reason this bill is coming before you, I have had an opportunity to work with this multiple organizations and have two constituents who actually are in the business of selling product that is based on industrial hemp. Specifically, there's a young woman by the name of Carolyn Moran. She's the owner of Living Tree Paper. She actually came before the Ag Committee in 1999, my last session, and I'd like to happily report that her business has continued to do very well. She now has product in Staples around the country, as well as on their mail order service for sale, and she also, from a more recent hearing, understands that she is going to be having product in other national chain stores that deal with office and paper supplies. Another individual by the name of Monty Matthews is the owner of University Lip Balm Company. It is a product that is used for moisturizing your lips, and he is actually in the process of getting contracts around the country from universities who are allowing their logo to be used and then actually are marketing it under their trade names. Both those individuals are not going to be here today because of short notice on the hearing and because of other business obligations they were not able to get back. I believe Ms. Moran is out of state. We did have a person, and one of the booklets that you have before you, the one that I had distributed today, is the Vote Hemp Report. A person with Hemp Tech came up for another hearing that we had on the Senate side, and unfortunately she was not able to accommodate the schedule of the committee either. Basically, what I'd like to just lay out for the committee, and then we'll take questions. I know the chair that you have a very packed agenda today, so I'm not sure how much time you wanted to spend on the item. But what I can tell you is I believe that Oregon is positioned in a place that could be very beneficial for our farmers to allow for industrial hemp to be grown in the state of Oregon. I believe that Oregon is in a position to be able to establish a seed bank for the United States. I believe that besides establishing the seed bank for the United States, they could, in fact, be in seed production for use such as in the lip balm or other type of health or food products that are used with hemp oil. We also believe that the production could be not only on the west side, which most people would consider to be the place where you would expect it to be grown within the Willamette Valley because of our rich agricultural heritage, as well as being the seed capital for grass in the United States, if not the world, that it would be very conducive for it to be produced there, but also on the east side. What we know are a number of individuals have contacted me who are interested in working with wheat farmers who are looking for rotation crops, and they believe that this would be an item that they would like to have the opportunity. It's very important for me to make sure that you understand, if you do not know the history of industrial hemp, but industrial hemp could be grown in this state legally up and through most of the 1960s. It wasn't until 1970 that we found that it became illegal to grow. So up until 33 years ago, it was no issue. I have just recently reviewed a copy of a video which actually has individuals back from the state of Kentucky who were complaining that their sons were not going to be able or not currently allowed to grow industrial hemp on their farm where their previous generations have. And some of these individuals have lived on the land for 6 to 8 generations. In the 1940s, during World War II, the United States government actually had a subsidy program for growing hemp called Hemp for Victory. Because of the need and the use of hemp for rope, canvas, and other materials, the United States government was, in fact, having production by farmers, and that was being subsidized for the war effort. One of the items I have not passed out to you, but I will make reference to it, and if anyone would like additional information, I'll make sure that each and every one of you get it. In the Popular Mechanics, dated February 1938, it was a featured item in that publication, New Billion Dollar Crop, referring to industrial hemp. It makes reference to how it was being grown and also how Henry Ford was actually utilizing the industrial hemp in his production of automobiles. There are numerous journals, periodicals, and catalogs that are available regarding industrial hemp. And I would, draw on Representative Nelson's history in Texas and just bring to her attention communities such as Hempstead, which is a community in Texas, as well as other communities around the country, actually have their roots from industrial hemp because of the growing of it, and they actually, the names of the communities were actually named in conjunction with the product. The other areas that I believe that we can see with this product being used, and when you look at the Vote Hemp report, pulp and paper, textiles, health and beauty products, food, as well as building supplies. To my amazement, when I started getting in this area back in 1996, I was surprised to see the diversity of this product and how it can, in fact, be used with other raw materials to make products that are very superior in many cases to others that are on the market today. In the building areas, composite board is one of the areas that we've seen. And believe it or not, today many automobile manufacturers are starting to use industrial hemp in conjunction with other polymers to making components for vehicles. The bill is pretty self-explanatory. What it will allow the farmers to do is to produce, possess, and be in the commercial product of industrial hemp. Definitions are given within Section 2 of the bill. It also establishes that it is an agricultural product that will, in fact, be regulated by the Department of Agriculture, and that inspections can and should occur to determine and make certain that the level of THC, which is what's probably the most concern that I've heard from law enforcement, is, in fact, under the level that is provided for under the statute. As I mentioned, it would permit farmers to grow. It also would permit them to have and retain seeds for future planting. We believe this is very important for individuals who are involved in this industry to be able to capture the seeds and reuse them and not be required to purchase seeds on an annual basis. The other parts are, I think, pretty self-explanatory. I'll take questions regarding that. I will tell you that I think that the issues that you'll be faced with in making your decision today or in the future is whether or not you believe Oregon is in a position to be able to go forward on this product or this production of industrial hemp. Clearly, this is a bifurcated process. What we're asking for is the state to give its blessing and understand that it will not be able to occur until the department or until the federal department, DEA, Department of Drug Enforcement Agency, and/or Congress gives permission for it to actually be grown in the United States, because currently it is not. This is the part that I have a lot of frustration with. We do not allow our farmers in this country to grow industrial hemp, but we will allow manufacturers and producers who use industrial hemp to import as much of industrial hemp raw into this country. Right now, the major production that we are drawing on for importation is in Canada to the north, and I'll mention to you that North Dakota, which is, of course, just across the border, has basically been looking across and saying, wow, what are they doing up there? Well, if they can grow industrial hemp there and that can be imported into the end of the country, why can't we? There's about a dozen states that have on the books research programs going on, or through, for the most part, through their land-grant colleges to determine the economics of reintroducing what has been in production in this country before. The other state, Hawaii, that I'll mention to you, has had an ongoing production. They've met the criteria that DEA has required, which is very large fencing, 24-hour monitoring, as well as lighting. I believe I'm not sure if it's on a 24-hour basis or not, but they have met the criteria to get the permit to continue to do the research that they're currently doing. The last part I will leave you with is, I guess, many of you know that in my private life, I serve as a prosecuting attorney and have done so since 1987. I've heard and been in panel discussions both here in the Capitol as well as around the state dealing with this issue. And when we have discussions with law enforcement that are involved as an opposition, their concern is that it's difficult to tell the difference between marijuana and hemp as it's grown. I would submit to you there's a vast difference because industrial hemp is grown as a row crop. It's very similar to corn. And if you ever saw a field of industrial hemp, you'll see that they're growing for the fiber. And what they're doing is growing for height. The longer or taller the plant, the longer and the fiber is. And that is what they're attempting to accomplish. On the other hand, marijuana is grown for a different purpose as to for production of the THC in the bud. And it is a completely different process because of how they grow it. Some people say, well, they're afraid that that you'll see industrial hemp fields being a cover for marijuana to be grown in. Clearly, anyone who wants to make that statement, I ask them to rebut who in their right mind as a farmer is going to put their land and all of their equipment, agricultural equipment, at risk to grow marijuana. Because the bottom line is this state, as well as the United States, have drug forfeiture laws. And they would be subject to those laws, and they could have all of their property forfeited to the government. The other part is that the fields under our program would, in fact, be registered under the Department of Ag. Everyone would know exactly where they're at, and they would be subject to inspection through the Department of Ag. I'll leave it at that, and if there's any other questions or questions that the committee may have, I'll try to answer them the best I can. If I'm not able to respond to your questions now, I'll try to call on the certified smart people who are unable to be here today to provide you information in the future.
Thank you, Representative. I wanted to ask you in regards to the point you were just articulating about the concerns that growing legalized hemp in America could lead to the disguise of growing illegal marijuana. How do they address that issue in Canada? I'm assuming marijuana is illegal in Canada?
As far as I know, it is. For the production, I know that one of the provinces was looking at some decriminalization for small possessions, but for the actual production, I do not know. I have not heard of anywhere in the North America continent that it is illegal to grow. My understanding is that they have pretty much similar safeguards as to production, knowing where it's being occurred, that there is, in fact, access to the fields as such. One thing that I will mention to you, if we were really looking at trying to, let's say, put a dent in marijuana grows that are occurring outside areas as compared to inside, you would want to have as much industrial hemp grown around, because there's a cross-pollination that's going to occur. And the cross-pollination is going to lower the level of the THC that is found in marijuana and, in fact, will be a drug control method.
Is it possible, Representative, that the cross-pollination could work the opposite way and make the hemp have a little higher THC?
I think it probably would. I mean, there's definitely that possibility, but I guess if you look at the size of the acreage that would be in production for industrial hemp as compared to what you would expect to find in the growing of illegal marijuana, you would, in fact, I think, find that you'd have probably more cross-pollination going from the hemp to the marijuana.
Just because of the number.
One other thing that brings up is I had an intern this year, one of the students from the University of Oregon's law school do some research for me. He actually came up, and I don't have the name of the product, but there's now means of aerial surveying that they can actually tell the distinction between industrial hemp and marijuana from his research.
Questions? Members? Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talked about kind of the stage one, stage two, this being stage one, stage two being at the federal level. What do you see as some of the specific benefits of having stage one precede stage two as opposed to awaiting the federal action, which I assume would be another option, mm-hmm. and then whenever the next legislative session is coming back and doing stage one? Are there some specific benefits of doing it in this order?
I believe there is, Chair Croft and Representative Hunt. What I would say is that we would want to position ourselves, because there are other states that are already taking this stage one step. And what we know is that this valley, the Willamette Valley, is the richest valley as for grass seed farming. And I believe that we want to be positioned for we can do that. I also believe that the more states that move forward in a productive and a positive way of wanting to see industrial hemp reintroduced in this country where it has been grown before, it will in fact change the discussions that you're seeing in D.C. What we have an understanding, there are many companies, Fortune 500 companies, that are actually willing to and wanting to see changes at the federal level. And those talks and negotiations continue on a day-to-day basis, from my understanding. And at some point, I do believe that we will see the reality that this is not something that should be confused and mislabeled as as an illicit drug. And it's just unfortunate that when the definitions took place in the Narcotic Enforcement Act of 70, 72, whenever it was, that it was broad enough that it actually took industrial hemp into the definition of marijuana.
Additional questions? Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have 14.
Mm-hmm. You have 14 questions?
Yes, sir. Could I just ask six?
Oh, that was a good move, Representative. If you could make those six quick questions, it would be helpful.
Six
thank
quick.
You.
Thank you. Who is number one in hemp production?
In the way of countries?
Yes. Please don't say Colombia.
No. The countries. I don't know if I can tell you, Representative Nelson, who is number one, but I can tell you the countries that are actually involved. There are Western European countries, including Germany and France, Middle Far East, China, and Canada. Those the Western European countries have been in production for a number of years. China, I don't think they've ever been out of production, and Canada recently came in production, probably in the last 3 or 4 years.
Okay, second question. What are the products that we use here in America made of hemp right now?
There are a vast number of them. The book that you have, the Vote Hemp Report, actually has a listing of them. What I can tell you is that there are automobile parts like consoles within vehicles, as well as some of the body parts of vehicles are being used include industrial hemp. It's through a composite board process where they're actually mixing it as a as part of like with polymers to make the product.
Follow-up is, are those auto parts used in hemp made in the U.S.?
The parts...
If they're made in China and shipped back here...
Representative Nelson, I apologize. I can't tell you where they're actually manufactured, if they're actually being made in the U.S. and then distributed to production lines, or if they're coming in from out of the country. I know that Audi, there are one or two German auto manufacturers that actually are using them, and I believe that General Motors and possibly Chrysler may be using some, but I can get back to you on that.
I appreciate it. And third question, environmental-wise, has there been any study of how healthy this is for the environment versus noxious weeds?
Mr. Chair.
Other noxious weeds?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, there have been. The reality is that we know that industrial hemp takes less pesticides to grow. And there was a study about OSU that basically said that they believe that it would take irrigation, so it would not be one that could be done exclusively in dry areas. I believe that through the process of the seed banking that you would, in fact, be able to permit that type of product to come forward.
Okay, and
one other thing I wanted to say about this, because this was very interesting, which I did not know until our last hearing. it's my understanding that industrial hemp actually has the properties of pulling heavy metals out of the soil, and then it, when it brings it into the plant, it actually is able to break the heavy metals down where the plant can still be used, and it actually is a cleanser for off of some heavy metals from the soil.
Good. Maybe get mercury, rid of mercury for us?
I'm not sure exactly.
Okay. Just kidding. How is it harvested? By combine? By hand? By
yes, combine if you're if
combine
on the front page.
That much?
Yeah.
And baled? Is it baled?
Yes, and or it can be rolled as, you know.
Rolled. So like
and you can see on the back is actually how a hemp field would look, and you can see how dense and tight it is. And so the you know, the sun that's necessary for good production on the THC of marijuana is not able to get to the complete plant, and that's why this is so distinct, in my opinion.
And for the benefit of representing buyers and myself, what is the THP or C
THC,
or whatever?
That is the component that is actually the euphoria of what gets you high on marijuana. What if you ask me what the technical term of it is, I will... Instead of trying to embarrass myself over the pronunciation, I'll get that to you and I'll give you some information.
Okay, we just didn't know what it what it was used for. And just finally,
never used it.
Okay. Are we are these two entities for whom you brought this bill? Are they currently able to procure hemp from China and Western Europe?
They are, in fact.
And we allow it in here. It's like elk meat. Last time, I guess.
Oh, it's.
We couldn't sell our own, but we could import it from New Zealand, 400 tons or
absolutely.
Something.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. We can produce. We can import as much as we want. And what both Ms. Moran and what Mr. Matthews said is, that if we actually had production here in the state, they believe that you'd actually have your different producers moving into the area so they could actually have direct access, and it would bring their costs down to provide the products in not only this state but around the country.
Thank you.
Representative, when I was vice chair of this committee 4 years ago, then Chair Wells had this hearing, and you had a lot of folks in here and displaying a lot of really interesting products and so forth. And we talked about the market and how the market was expanding. Is the market still expanding worldwide for hemp-type products?
It's my understanding it is. There is one caveat to that, and that's basically the position that DEA has taken on in the hemp area that involves consumption, that they are basically now trying to promulgate rules that would say that anything that would be induced into the body would be prohibited. And okay. What we know is that the U.S. is one of the leading importers of hemp products because of the demand and request. So in the future, I think you're going to see it could go either way depending on how these rules actually are carried forward, and they are in the process of being legally challenged in the federal court.
So does this, and I just skimmed through it quickly, but does this have any article to the effect of an increased usage worldwide?
I'm not sure if it does worldwide, okay. But it does talk about how it can be used and how it is actually being used, yeah. And the demand. What I can tell you is Ms. Moran, who is again the owner of Living Tree Paper, was able to provide the information before as to how her company has grown. The thing that's interesting, I mean, if you think about it, there's a lot of individuals who would like to get their products into national chain stores. She's been able in the last year and a half to get into Staples. My understanding is I believe Office Depot or Office Max, one of the other two, are in the process of contracting with her company to bring in product there. And she also has contracts out of with Warner Brothers for providing the paper that is used for CD covers. So that little part that goes inside the CD is actually she's providing some of that product to some of the recording industry.
And my last question is, Chair, and then Representative Nelson, and will there be anyone else asking questions? How has one of the things that was curious about this to me as a farmer 4 years ago is how does the farming industry think judge this concept of growing it here in Oregon. Have you had any discussions with anybody in the farming community about this lately, in the last maybe year or so?
I have not. Okay. What I've relied on are other individuals who are, let's say, more direct contact with farmers, specifically on the east side, as to their desires to see rotation crops. It's my understanding there's more interest today than there were 4 years ago.
Okay.
And, you know, it's one of the things I will say, and somewhat in closing, is that I am somewhat surprised that we have an agency in the sense of dealing with law enforcement issues that want us to make decisions as to the economics of a product. To me, it's always been supply and demand and what the market bear, with everyone understanding that, you know, there's no guarantees. But clearly, I don't expect any farmer to be jumping into producing industrial hemp without having some certainty that he or she is going to have a market for that product.
Sure. And Representative Nelson, you have one more question quickly?
Yes, I do. Thank you very much, Representative Prosensky. As we talked about this, I'm assuming by what you just said, we've never had a market study. We don't know an economic value. I want to know, how much can we do? How many people will it employ? You know, what will it mean, generate, you know, for the state? Has anybody done any studies like that? It's unusual. They haven't.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, at this point, I don't know of one being specifically done for the state of Oregon. Some of these other states that are actually in the process of going through regulation and approval through their legislature has, in fact, started that approach to determine. One of the things we have to realize...
Somebody started hops, didn't they, and barley the same way?
Yeah. I mean, and this is the thing that's really interesting as to when you look at the market demand. Clearly, if you look at economics today, it would cost more to be producing industrial hemp than it did when it was in full production, because you had the equipment in place, you had the markets in place, and so it's just like anything else. It's really being reintroduced, and because it's being reintroduced, it's going to take a period of time for it to be application-wise to be utilized to actually, I think, give us a true sense of what the economics would be. Well, I'll tell you, this is a production from Living Tree Paper, where Carolyn Moran has samples of the different type of papers that she now currently sells. And then, as I mentioned, there are many different books, Hemp Times.
Does she make that here in Oregon?
She has it produced in, my understanding, in three places. One, no, not here in Oregon. And because the mills that she's currently working with is back on the East Coast, one in Spain, if I'm not mistaken, and I believe possibly one in Canada. She is currently talking to someone from her testimony previously in Washington State that where they may want to do a conversion.
And what do you call it, industrial hemp? Why do you call it industrial hemp?
To try to distinguish it in the sense of what its application is as compared to being categorized as marijuana.
But they don't call marijuana marijuana when they're talking about it for medicinal use. Do
they do, medical.
I thought they call it
cannabis.
Oh, there's many different
cannabis.
If I may,
yes. Go ahead, Ray.
Representative Nelson, one of the street names of marijuana is hemp, and I want to distinguish between any connotation of street name of something and the industrial things that are that the good representative testifying is alluding to.
Well, what was the original name of hops?
Hops.
And barley.
Hops and barley there.
Free beer.
All right.
Beer and whiskey?
This conversation has degenerated decisively. Representative, your closing comment.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to hopefully not embarrass myself too much, but Bart has handed me the THC, tetrahydrocannabinol.
Cannabinol.
That's what it. That's the technical thing, and I can get you more information about that.
Okay.
I know my limits.
All right. Thank you very much. We're going to close public hearing and a work session on this House bill. Thank you very much, Representative. Appreciate it. All right. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 2893. And Representative Barnhart, you have some amendments. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Barnhart, State Representative, House District 11. Yes, we prepared amendments 1 Dash 1 in an attempt to deal with some of the issues which came up at the committee's hearing. And I apologize for not having gotten this to the committee administrator before this. I thought we had gotten it out, and apparently it didn't get out until today. The key difference between the bill as printed and the amendment is essentially to leave out the last line on the bill and to instead insert in the earlier in ORS 672.525 a sub 9, which is at the bottom of the amendments, which says a person does not publicly practice or offer to publicly practice geology solely because the person testifies or prepares to testify in a public hearing. That seems to get at the issue quite a bit more directly than the original bill did, and hence the reason for the proposed amendment. And I know you had an extensive hearing on this matter before, so unless there's something else, I'll stop.
Questions, members? Yes, Representative.
Just a quick question. Thank you, Representative Barnhart. I assume you've been getting all the emails, too. Do you have any comment on those that are opposed to this bill?
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, I have received a number of emails from of people in a variety of positions on the mm-hmm. bill. They seem to fall into several categories, if I can editorialize a little. One category is, yeah, I like this bill. Another category is, I hate this bill, and then there's some description of the bill that suggests that they don't understand what the issue is. And the third one is a category in which they say, I don't like this bill because the amendments that we're talking about don't really get at the issue. And it's that third category, I think, that we're trying to address with the language on the bottom of the Dash 1 amendment. The other two, of course, the first one I'm happy with because they agree with the position I've taken. I don't know why.
You didn't know.
I would say this. When you're dealing with the scope of practice of a profession and a licensed profession, I think it is important to be careful about how you make changes in it, because it's possible to make unintended changes in it. It's also, I think it's also important not to be afraid to make changes in it when it's been demonstrated that there's a problem. And I think that the hearing that you had last time demonstrated pretty clearly that there is a problem or potentially a problem. And the object of this is to make certain that public bodies have available to them all of the information that they need in order to make good decisions, without the threat of retaliation on the part of someone who files a complaint with the geology board. And I think that's what number 9, sub 9, does here.
Thank you.
Additional questions? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we're in work session on this bill. Representative Hunt?
Mr. Chair, I would move that we adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2893.
Members, it's been moved we adopt the Dash 1's 2893 discussion.
Yep.
Representative Nelson.
Yes. Mr. Chair, frankly, not having time to review this is making me a little crazy, because I think this was a breach of an individual's First Amendment right, and now I'm sorry, and I have the greatest respect for Representative Barnhart, but I haven't had a chance to study this, and I don't even know what I'm voting on, frankly. And maybe you are the good assistant here.
Well, I
Mr.
think
Kelly,
Representative, you were
tell us what this bill means.
And we can certainly do that.
I was here, and I heard the testimony. And Mr. Barnhart,
okay.
Representative Barnhart was not here, but I don't. Right now, I have no clue what we're voting on.
Great. Would you like to share with us what this amendment does?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Representative Nelson, as we all know, the original issue was a First Amendment freedom of speech guarantee and what most people commonly know as a slap suit on this issue. In my reading, Mr. Chair, of the amendments, if they were to be inserted into the bill, they would define the public practice of geology as some specific issues, and it also defines how somebody publicly practices the profession. So you have a two-part definition. You have what geology in the technical sense is and what a person must do to qualify in that technical sense of the practice of geology. What is excluded is a specific case that was brought to the committee's attention of the individual providing advice at no fee and then getting sued by the department because he provided that advice. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, in light of this, would it be possible to ask Representative Hunt if he could withdraw his motion in order for us to bring Mr. Reed up to explain if this is his understanding of this amendment as he previously testified?
Representative, he doesn't need to withdraw his motion. We can do that. I'd be happy to do that. Mr. Reed, would you come forward, please?
Yes.
Representative, your question to Mr. Reed?
Thank you. Mr. Reed, because geology happens not to be one of my areas of expertise, I don't have very many, as a matter of fact, but could you explain this amendment? Is this -1 amendment, is what I'm talking about, does this clarify an individual in your position who would find themselves getting advice, does this clarify the protection you or someone else just giving an opinion should have the right to do in Oregon and America? And is this, do you approve of it?
Yes, I do. This does clarify that point. There are two essential parts to these amendments. Well, first of all, let me comment that these amendments address essentially all of the State Board of Geologists Examiners' concerns with the original bill. Many of them have been removed, and this amendment addresses the two key points, which is the definition of public practice of geology being for another. The words for another on line 5 are a key part of this. The original law, the original definition of public practice of geology was vague on that point. And so this establishes that practice means you have a client, that a geologist...
Okay, on line 5 where now?
Line 5 of the amendment itself, of 2893-1.
Okay.
It says, public practice of geology means the performance for another of geological service or work, such as consultation and so on. So the amendment is an improvement over the existing law by making it explicit that it means for another, which language, by the way, exists in many other states. I've looked at a lot of other state laws, and that language, either for another, for a third party, or for others, is explicit in many other states. So that is important because in my case, I testified on my own behalf. I didn't testify for another.
Okay.
And so that's why that's critical. The second key thing that this amendment does is at the bottom on lines 20 through 22 is it establishes explicitly that a person may testify. So that part says that a person does not publicly practice if the person testifies or prepares to testify in a public proceeding. And the term public proceeding there comes from language suggested by the State Board of Geologist Examiner's attorney in reference to public testimony to a body like a county commission, which is my circumstance, where that testimony has been invited by the body, invited from the public by the body, and So the intent of Part 9 there at the bottom of the page is to make it clear that that testimony to a public body to address a proposition on the table before that body in the circumstance of invited public input is protected. And so, yes, the answer to your question originally is yes, it does what we need to do.
Okay, and just to follow up, I just want to say thank you for bringing this to us, and, you know, God, you know, protect our right to speak, and heaven help us. I don't care what board it is, or governor, or legislator, or public body, America, I'm glad we've got
the for the record, Ray, we need to make a correction of a statement here. I think perhaps an impression that we may have in the committee. Ray?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I had stated that Mr. Reed, or Board of Examiners, had filed suit against Mr. Reed. That was not correct. According to the Board of Geologists Examiners, Mr. Reed filed suit against the board.
For the record, we need
for
to
the
correct
record,
that.
I needed to correct that.
Okay, thank you. Members, we have a motion.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Is there any objection to adopting the dash one? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2893 to the floor with the DUPAP recommendation.
Members, Representative Hutt moves House Bill 2893 to the floor as amended with the DUPAP recommendation. Discussion? Representative Beyer.
I was leaning this way. I do have a few concerns about this bill, and I still have a couple questions. I'm going to go ahead and vote for it, and hopefully I can get my other questions answered in the meantime. So.
Okay. Additional? Representative Gilma.
Mr. Chair, I will be a no on this bill, and it's not because I don't totally agree with what you've done here. I really think that we've already solved the problem, and I hope you can't prove me wrong later on.
Further comments? Clerk, call the roll, please.
Representative Hunt.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
No.
Representative Ward.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
No.
I heard it.
We almost had it.
Aye. House Bill 2893 is amended and passed to the floor with a DUPAS recommendation. And Representative Barnhart, would you...
Thank you.
Representative Barnhart will carry the bill. Thank you. We're closing the work session on House Bill 2893. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 291. Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ted Farioli, and Mr. Chairman, I'd like to beg the chair's indulgence and the committee's indulgence for a moment or two on Senate Bill 291.
Senator, we love to indulge you.
And I love to beg. I started out with a very simple concept of Senate Bill 291. It was to remove a three-mile limit between hunting preserves. The reason I was interested in doing that is that there are several landowners in my district of 34,000 square miles who would like to engage in this practice of operating licensed hunting preserves, mostly for bird hunting. And in the course of having this bill drafted and having the bill heard on the Senate side and passed, I have met some wonderful people, the licensees that actually operate these hunting preserves in the state of Oregon. And in the course of those discussions, I surfaced two additional concerns, one of which was that requirement for obtaining a license in Oregon for a hunting preserve on private land involves a conditional use permit. And approximately half of the currently licensed landowners that have licenses through Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to operate hunting preserves were not notified by their county jurisdictions that they need to go through that land use process. So only about half of the currently licensed preserves have been through the the conditional use permit process that was required. Any of the environmental impacts of having a licensed hunting preserves in Oregon for these facilities has certainly already been felt. And in discussing the solution to this issue with LCDC and other folks, it was agreed with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and others that the best solution to this was to simply grandfather in the currently licensed hunting preserves. And then in so doing, make it abundantly clear to the folks in the counties that they need to take people through this conditional use process. Another issue that we tried to deal with was there is no current language in rule or statute that allows sporting clays. And I'd love to deal with that issue in this bill. Unfortunately, the relating clause to my bill does not allow the addition of sporting clays, or I would be asking this committee to include not only the grandfathering, but the sporting clays. In the course of meeting with and discussing this issue with the bulk of our licensees, it was requested that I change my original objective of removing the 3-mile separation and essentially add back a half mile. And that would be for escapement, for the health of birds, for distance between these operations.
Excuse me, Senator Ferriero, would you have those folks just sit down behind you there? If would, thank you. Please continue, Senator.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chairman, the bill that I would bring before you, if I had the right amendments, which I do not have, I have gone through the process of getting 3 different drafts of the amendments, none of which actually accomplished what it is that I intend to do today, which, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee would be: amend the bill so we add a half mile distance between licensed facilities and grandfather all of the currently existing facilities. That is the purpose to which I have appeared today to ask you to do. I've been advised today by a wonderfully attentive staff of the Senate Majority Office that the amendment doesn't do exactly what I thought it would do. And that's been confirmed with representatives from LCDC who are in support of the grandfathering in, since there's no point in disrupting half of the licensees in the state of Oregon, since any environmental effects have already been felt. There is a good purpose to clarifying the fact that we do need to have those facilities permitted in a conditional use permit process, and that will make that very clear to the counties what the authority is and what the limits of their authority is and what the requirements are. But, Mr. Chairman, what I'd like you to do in today is simply invite other testimony, because some folks have traveled here to speak to this issue, and be aware that I am working now with legislative counsel to try to draft an amendment with the assistance of LCDC staff and Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife staff that will change the distance between the 1/2 mile and grandfather in all the currently licensed facilities in Oregon. We still can't do anything about that sporting clay thing with this bill, although I'll be happy to work with folks from Department of Fish and Wildlife and others to find a vehicle to allow the outright use of sporting clays in hunting preserve licensure in Oregon. Mr. Chairman, I have a voluminous correspondence I've written to every single licensee in the state of Oregon in this issue. We've talked to most of them on the telephone or email back and forth. There was a lot of discussion in this process about having a safety buffer inside the boundaries of hunting preserves. And after discussions with county planners and ODFW officials, it was felt that since every one of these facilities will be unique and sited on their own circumstances through a licensing process through the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and a conditional use permit process at the county level, the smart thing to do would be allow those people in that permitting process to take up the issues of buffers for safety. So that is not a topic in the bill. Mr. Chairman, this started out as a very simple little bill. It's become a very interesting learning experience, and through that process, as I said before, I've met some real nice people out there trying to keep their families in a rural setting and run an operation, which Oregon sportsmen really enjoy. And so, Mr. Chairman, that is the sum of my testimony today, and I will be requesting another work session on this bill. I'm told that the amendments can be produced by Monday.
Okay. Senator, I wanted to clarify something I thought I heard you say in the latter part of your testimony just a moment ago.
Yes.
About counties your bill does not specifically say that counties can have safety buffers or negotiate that in approval of these things?
Mr. Chairman, to that question, there were two different approaches that were suggested. One is that the safety buffers can be and are routinely dealt with in the permitting process at Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. So if it's an issue of concern, it certainly could be dealt with in the permitting process or in the licensure process. And each of the counties, when they go through their conditional use permit, certainly have the authority to impose a safety buffer if they feel it's necessary. So there's two different levels and two different layers of government that could deal with the safety buffer issue. And since each one of these is cited in a unique situation, I didn't think it was necessary to put that in statute.
Okay. So permit process and then the local approval of a conditional use permit.
Would both be venues to address the issue of a safety zone.
Okay. Representative Wirth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Ferriel, can you tell me what was the purpose or how they arrived at the three-mile separation to begin with?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wirth, I can. I originally assumed it had to do with escapement for the birds. Or some health reason or some biological reason or wintering over of the birds that escape from these facilities. As it happens, none of those things were the case. These birds are bred for the purpose that they're used for, and that is sport hunting. They are not very well equipped to deal with Oregon winter, so most of them do not winter over. A few may escape. Very few of them will survive the winter. Most of them will become feed for hawks, eagles, coyotes, and foxes. There was no underpinning biologically. I checked with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife about the biological reason for a three-mile limit. There isn't any. It was simply something suggested when this opportunity and venue was created by the legislature. I suppose it related to not wanting to have hunting preserves right next door to each other across the landscape.
Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Senator, I think you're getting off lucky today, at least so far. Are you going to hang around in case
I will stay to hear the testimony, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate very much the opportunity to have the hearing, and I very much apologize for not having the amendments that would solve the problem for...
Perfectly all right, Senator. We'd be happy to consider this issue further once we get a chance to see your amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chair, I'd like to call Ron Eber from the department and also ODF&W, Ron Anglin. If the two of you would come forward, please. Welcome, Ron. What is your take on this in this bill as it's currently written and as the proposed amendments are as you understand them?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ron Eber. I'm the Farm and Forest Land Specialist for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. As the Senator Ferrioli explained, the amendments, we are in full support and are trying to work with ODF&W and with the folks that have these hunting and fishing preserves to get them grandfathered in. The hunting preserves have been allowed use in a farm zone since 1973, and what led to some of them getting their permits from Fish and Wildlife but not getting local land use approval, we're unsure of, but the fact is they acted in good faith. They got their permits, and this seems to be the most judicious way to rectify the situation. And we're committed to seeing that through.
Okay. Questions of Ron? Ron Anglin, for the record.
Chair Krupp, members of the committee, for the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator, ODFW. Likewise, ODFW would be in support of the amendments as discussed by Senator Ferrioli. They would have, from our standpoint, no biological impact and would work well with the preserve operators and allowing them to continue business.
Okay. Questions? Hearing none, thank you, gentlemen, both very much. I know there's a number of people who have traveled some distance to get here today, and I'm going to invite you all to come and testify. And I'm going to start with those that I know for the moment. Matt, you want to come forward? And then I'll kind of go down through the line here, and we'll hear both pro and con. Welcome. For the record, state your name.
Great, thank you. Matt Cyrus, Deschutes County. We have a a small shooting preserve over in the Sisters area, and I just wanted to express my full support to this bill that Senator Farioli has graciously put forward and the amendments. The bottom line is there's roughly half of the shooting preserves in this state have not gone through the county approval process, went through the state licensing process, licensed operating facilities, including some of the oldest and largest in the state. Because of the time frame involved in the process of going through the county permitting process, many of them would be closed this next year and probably would not reopen. And in fact, in our specific county, there is no language on the books even for a conditional use permit. So we would be looking at a 2 to 3 year process to get approvals, even to get county approval and start from scratch again. So I would certainly encourage the committee to help us out and grandfather the existing ones. This won't impact any of them that have made have come into existence after 2000, because after January of 2000, everyone has had to go through the county land use process anyway. So this will only affect those that, that are older than that, that, like I say, went through the state licensing, and at that point there was no county requirement.
Okay. Members, questions of Matt?
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, we have the Underhills, who have driven quite a distance to get here. Welcome. And also welcome to, as I understand, their daughter, our very well-known Jean Underhill Wilkinson from the Farm Bureau. Although I'm not sure you're here on behalf of Farm Bureau, or are you?
That's right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. Again, I'm Jean Underhill Wilkinson. You know me as a lobbyist for the Oregon Farm Bureau. I'd like to introduce my parents here today, Martin Underhill and Lavelle Underhill. Martin Underhill goes by the name of Buck. They have some concerns about Senate Bill 291 that they would like to share with you. The Farm Bureau isn't involved in this bill at the moment, but I was asked to join the Family Farm Partnership over the last year, and so I am very much involved, a vested owner in the family farm, and so I, as a property owner, I share their concerns. Thank you.
Welcome. For the record, state your name, please.
Yes, Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Lavelle Underhill, and I'm here today with my husband, Martin Buck Underhill, and we represent Martin Underhill Farms. I want to tell just a little bit about our backgrounds that in regard to the land and the love of the land and wanting to nurture it and hand it down to future generations. I was raised in Sherman County at Bacalo at Cheers Bridge. My husband was born and raised in Shotgun Canyon in Duper in Wasco County. Some of the land that, well, the land that I own in Sherman County at this time has, my father bought it during World War II, and we lived right there at Shears Bridge. Bucky's family has owned their land since 1876 and 1879. So we've been there quite a while. We know the land, and we hope to take care of it. I'm opposed to the current version of Senate Bill 291. And when I speak of I'm just me, I want to, excuse me if I just refer to myself, but we represent landlords. We have 13 landlords, and they're looking at us to say, help us take care of our property. And there are fellow farmers who aren't here today, but I'm speaking for them at their request, and it represents over 40,000 acres. So we have a great concern here. When Senate Bill was enacted, and it was, and the ordinances or the rules were sent down to the county, no, I am told by the county planner, there is nothing in the conditional use permit or in the comprehensive land use requirements does not say anything about a buffer for shooting preserves. Therefore, they said, we have no foundation to address it. It has brought concern, it has brought problems, and it has brought attorneys involved. I'm asking that there be a buffer. I'm speaking for the east of the mountain. When I say the mountain, I mean Mount Hood. Because I don't know what would be best for west of the mountain, and I don't want to speak for those people. They need to speak for themselves. But east of the mountain, we have a great concern there. There are no buffers for these shooting preserves. Therefore, when a shooting preserve owner, which many times the landowner, in our instance, up there in Wasco County and other counties east of the mountain, they do not have, the owner is not operating that shooting preserve. They lease it out. And the shooting operator either raises their own birds or they buy them. Now, the shooting preserve, as you know, goes from dusk or from dawn till dusk, August 1 through March 31st, 8 months out of the year, 7 days a week. Us that do not care to have shooting preserves, and we don't have them, we have no protection on our side of the fence. The shooting preserve can go right up next to your fence. And my concerns are safety, big game habitat, big game hunting, and as I mentioned, the safety and the noise pollution, general farming such as field spraying, tractors. Did I mention livestock? Okay, and the livestock there. We have no protection because we do not have a buffer. The counties are telling us that we do not have any foundation at all to implement a buffer. All I'm asking for today is that we, as landowners, next to the shooting preserves, be given a setback or a buffer, whichever one you want to call it, to give us some protection on our property. If this bill is enacted, or an amendment to Bill 291 becomes active, we not only have them at 3 miles away, we have them a half a mile away. If someone had a piece of property and it was a half a mile wide, they would have to have a shooting preserve on each side of them. So our concern is to have a buffer to give us protection on our property.
Okay. Buck, do you want to say something? Welcome and state your name.
Chairman and committee members. I think my wife has pretty well illustrated my opinions too. We have a version here. We want to hand this out, don't we?
Oh yes, I forgot to.
And
sorry.
Just a writing.
Would you hand that to David, please? David, thank you. Please continue.
I think we need. I do think we farmers, owners, property owners that have proper property next to these. Preserves need some protection. And I have nothing against the preserves. It's an economic help to the farming economics, which we all need. But I do think we need some protection. And all we're asking is the ability to instruct the local county to give us an opportunity to request some setback or buffer, however you want to term it. And I guess that's not taking any more of your time. I guess that's about the end of it.
So if I'm understanding your testimony correctly, and I think what I just heard you say, Buck, is you don't oppose having more hunting preserves. You just want to make sure, from in your opinion, that there is some consideration given to a safety buffer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you're saying, right?
Exactly right.
Okay. Do you, Senator Farioli made the statement in response to my query, as you heard, that there are two opportunities for you to request in the conditional use permit and then also the licensing process, not the permit process, but the licensing process with ODFNW. Is he incorrect in that matter, or
I don't
does
agree
your
with
county
him.
Simply not recognize that you can request that?
It's not only our county in Wasco County, but it's also in Sherman County and Gilliam County. They're telling us that there is nothing in the comprehensive land use plan nor in the county ordinances for shooting preserves to give the neighboring landowner protection, or they're calling it buffer. They say there is nothing in there that mentions a buffer. Therefore, they said we can't really We don't have any platform to go by because there's nothing listed in there.
Okay, Gene, I'm going to ask Ron Eber to come forward. And Gene, if you could step away for a moment, and Ron, if you could come up. I think this is a very important point, and we need to clearly understand what the statute or the goals say here in this matter. Ron?
Chair Krupp, members of the committee, Ron Eber again. Just to clarify, and I'd be more than glad to talk with the county planners in question, but private hunting preserves are a conditional use in the exclusive farm use zone under 215.283 sub 2, I forget the number, but as such, they are subject to approval under the standards in 215.296, which require the county to determine that that use will not significantly interfere or increase the cost of accepted farm or forest practices on adjacent land. Further, under
Eber, would you mind to slow down just a little bit?
Certainly.
Because you're talking all these numbers, and for us who've never been in this business, I didn't quite get it. I want to.
I apologize.
No, that's okay.
Why don't you recite the ORS?
Okay. Yeah, the conditional uses are subject to the standards in ORS 215.296. And the key one I want to address is subsection 10, which says nothing in this section shall prevent a local governing body approving a use allowed, a conditional use in the farm zone, from establishing standards in addition to those set forth in this statute, or from imposing conditions to ensure conformance with such additional standards. So the authority to the counties is clearly there and is regularly exercised, I know, throughout the state. And I would be more than glad to discuss with the counties in question to point that out to them.
So it sounds to me like what you just read says that the counties can impose a greater restriction. Correct?
Chair Krupp, that's correct. If when a conditional use comes forward and in showing that there could be an interference or a problem with it, the county wanted to impose a setback or something to keep the hunting away from adjacent dwellings or property, I believe they can do so.
Have you had an opportunity to see their the Underhills? I want to ask you a question. If this language was adopted, would it be consistent, in your opinion, with the intent of or the ORS you just stated?
Chair Krupp, I don't see any conflict. This, I would see, could be either done in the land use process or in connection with the permit that is gotten from Fish and Wildlife.
Okay, so if this language were to be adopted, it would, I mean, it appears to me anyway, and in accordance with what the Underhills are asking, it would, in essence, I guess maybe clarify that the county has the authority to facilitate.
Chair Krupp, I would say it would be direction to the counties to actually facilitate these agreements, and it would be totally consistent with their authority under the land use statute.
So it goes a little bit further than what the current statute says, but it's still consistent with what the statute says.
Chair Krupp, that's correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman, we have requested setbacks consideration along these lines, and we've been unsuccessful. That's it.
They've refused to consider, but I thought, Lavelle, that you said that was because they felt that they had no authority to do so. Is that correct?
Correct. More than one county. Yet that is true. So if this was implemented, it would make it very clear to the counties, the county planners, that, okay, if this person comes in and they feel that they need a buffer, then they could have something to build on. Right here in this implementation.
When you use the word shall in this business, and your daughter obviously being in the business and understanding language issues,
Do you think it shouldn't be shall?
Well, that's not my call, but I'm just making the observation that what we're saying here, if we use that word, is that counties shall facilitate agreements with adjoining property owners who request buffers. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, does that create any burden on the county to do that? And I'm going to see anybody from counties here.
May I say something?
Sure. Absolutely, Lavelle.
Within the state, each county, the only thing that I would like to see is each county could then use this information in this paragraph and determine on how much of a setback, whether they need a setback, so that they could make a determination in working with the applicant and the joining landowner. Because some shooting preserves I have been talking to already gave themselves a buffer. They say, we haven't had a problem, we've given ourselves a buffer. Some have given as much as a half mile if they have a big enough acreage. Now I'm talking about a 15,000 acre with six shooting preserves on it. They said, we gave ourselves a buffer of a half mile in some areas, a full mile in the others, in order to protect our neighbor. Now, that's why if this was put into the Senate Bill 291 or a new version of it, then this would take care of that, and the counties feel that they would have the authority then to work with the applicant and the shooting preserve or the joining landowner in order to work something out, because every county's different. Every county's needs within the county, there will be needs and maybe not need. And that is flexible so that it doesn't bring a burden onto everyone. Everyone has to conform just to this. They can decide amongst themselves and work it out. So,
well, it seems to me that you're getting at the right thought in terms of trying to clarify to the counties. But on the other hand, I have to say that I think the reading of the statute we just heard gives the counties the ability to do this. It sounds to me like counties don't know that they have the... If they're telling you this, it sounds to me like they're in error, actually.
This is why I feel that it should be in clear enough language. Okay. It's hidden. It's hidden. Even for me, it's hidden. a clear enough language that they could fully understand and we could all understand.
Well, there ought to be a law that demands that all statute has to be written in plain English. And apparently sometimes it isn't, because it's very confusing for us at times, and that's why we often have to have legislative counsel come. Ron, could you step away for a moment, or do you have you anything else to add to this matter this time?
I thought I asked him a question.
Oh, okay.
Is it EBER, Mr. Eber?
Correct, Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Are you the man who issues license for preserves?
Chair Krupp, Representative Nelson.
What is your... Are you DSL? No. What are you?
I'm with the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and I'm the Farm and Forest Land Specialist, and so I'm the one who works with counties on the administration of exclusive farm and forest zones. We do not issue any permits per se.
So may I ask you who does? Who issues the permits for these?
The local county would.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Okay, what does this mean then in this... I beg your pardon. So it's the State and Wildlife Commission that gives the license.
That's correct. And, in fact, we're going to hear from them in a moment because Ron's going to step away and the other Ron's going to sit down. At my request.
Well, Mr. Chair, what I wanted to find out, and I don't know how to find it out, however long we've been doing this, I mean, I would think there would have been some concern for safety and security of people first, animals second, and so I'm having a hard time understanding why.
That's a very good question, and I think that Ron Anglin can probably answer that from his viewpoint of the agency which actually grants the license, Representative. Ron, you want to address that concern?
Chair Krupp, members of the committee, for the record, Ron Anglin again. Would you mind repeating the question for me, Representative Nelson?
Yes, thank you. restraining them, passing this.
Boy, the two of you down there, I don't know.
It's the allergy.
You don't have
time.
Stars or anything.
It's just, yeah. But what I'm concerned about is how long have we been issuing, Mr. England, thank you, Mr. Chair, this license without concern for the proper, for the safety of people first, other people, and livestock. I mean, I'm astounded that a state who has as its top priority safety and security of its people has been doing this without caring about the safety of the people or the livestock. According to what this bill says.
Ron, what process do you engage in that takes into account those issues?
Chair Krupp, Representative Nelson, I guess to give you a little bit of background, when the county land use planning regulations were adopted back in the 70s, it was in the early 80s that our agency did a review and determined what actions were required to receive a conditional use permit and as related to any of our permits. At that point in time, somehow the shooting preserves were missed by our agency. We didn't discover that until the late 90s, and at that point in time, in 2000, is when we started requiring all new shooting preserves to get a conditional use permit. And it's our understanding that under the conditional use permit process, that the counties, which is probably the appropriate place to determine safety zones, buffers, and whether it's an accepted practice because they're familiar with the local level, that they would have the ability through the permitting their permitting process to take that into account and make those decisions. On all new permits, we will not issue that permit until we have a conditional use permit from the appropriate county since 2000. And for those that did not have the conditional use permit, we have sent out a letter this winter stating that you need to get that. We've got some that are going through that process right now. Once they have a conditional use permit, they're not required to go back and have that reviewed, and we just continue to issue their permit on an annual basis. If it is brought to our attention that there's a problem, we would probably refer the neighbors directly to the county because they're the ones that would govern county land use regulations and not us as a state wildlife agency. So we refer that back to the county because it does fall within their jurisdiction. We have no jurisdiction over that as an agency.
So, Ron, you're saying that your process doesn't take into account risk of injury, persons, livestock, personal property, or does? Yes or no?
No, it does not, Chair Krupp.
That's at the county level.
Chair Krupp, they would have to address that through the CUP process. Conditional use permit. I'm sorry, Representative.
Okay.
They would have to address that through their local process at the first time of the hearing.
Okay, so if someone was putting in making application to you to put in a preserve next to the Underhills, and the Underhills came to you as an agency and requested that you make granting of that permit dependent upon looking at their concerns of risk of injury and that type of thing, what would you do? Can you make it, by authority, can you make it conditional?
Chair Krupp, no, we cannot. We would refer them directly back to the county, and the county, through the land use planning laws, has the ability to do that. And I'm unfamiliar that if there was a need to be a change or a felt there was a need to be a change, what the process would be. DLCD representative would be more appropriate to answer that. Again, that addresses all new ones from this point forward. Those that are already within the system, either with an existing CUP, all those that have an existing CUP would not be governed by any of this.
Follow up, yes. Mr. Chair, what does a private hunting preserve license cost?
Chair,
inclusive of surcharges and all those other things I've learned to ask about now.
Chair Krupp, Representative Nelson, I don't remember exactly off the top of my head. I believe it's around $10. Is it 100? Okay, it's $100 a year.
$100 a day, $100 a year.
It's 300 and something.
$300
for our application.
Oh,
Representative.
I'm sorry.
Okay. We need to move on, okay?
What do we do with this money? That's what I want to know.
The licensing money for private, where does it go?
It
goes into our agency.
We don't do anything with it.
It goes into our agency, and it processes the bands that we help supply on startup. It helps fund the individual who oversees the Shooting Preserve program and oversees the annual licensing of that. It does not cover the costs of the program.
Okay. We're going to move on because we've got 20 minutes left and we've got some other bills to hear. Obviously, Senator Farioli has some additional amendments to bring. Gene, do you want to say anything else at this time? Feel free to come forward and clarify your review of the recent discussion.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I want to make it very clear that the Farm Bureau is not involved in this bill, so that makes me somewhat uncomfortable. But from what I understand, my parents have been through the county planning process with a shooting preserve that was proposed to be put in that covers three sides of their property in a horseshoe shape. And obviously they wanted some sort of buffer since shotguns the shots out of shotguns can travel 200 to 300 yards, and they're farming right on the other side of the fence and have livestock there. Now, many times I think we'll find that the counties have not taken up that authority and not taken any responsibility to deal with the issues with adjoining property owners. So I think the idea is to clearly provide in statute direction to the counties that they need to deal with the concerns of adjoining property owners for those safety issues.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Chair, I'd like to call George Dern. And then I know there's some other folks here, and I'll call them in a moment. George, welcome. Members, George is a constituent of mine from the Sweet Home area. Welcome, George. For the record, state your name, please.
Thank you. George Dern. We own and operate DK Wildlife Ranch out of Sweet Home, Oregon. And like these other folks, we come from a long line of ranchers. I have a statement I'd like to present, but first of all, we have a buffer on our own place for safety. We post that voluntarily.
I see.
And I would be very, very opposed to having a mandatory delineated type of buffer handed down, because buffers can vary, the need for safety zones can vary depending upon the situation. In some places, a couple hundred feet, and other places, maybe a greater distance. But that should be up to the owner, operator of the hunting preserve. Before I allow my guests to go to the field, I give each and every one of them, even after they hunt on my place numerous times, a safety lecture on firearms and point out the posted boundaries on my place. I've got them very clearly delineated with flags and white PVC markers to protect adjacent properties. A 200-yard setback buffer, as I've heard, would put me out of business, period. We're not a large outfit. 200 yards would just simply take away all of the land that we have to hunt. I have talked with Don Schellenberger of the Farm Bureau, and his position was that he's in favor of hunting preserves. One good thing that's come out of all this discussion on Senate Bill 291 is that we, as hunting preserve operators, are an independent bunch of critters, and we don't talk to each other that much. But we have started talking to each other, and some of these issues we could if we develop an organization, which there is talk now that we are going to form an organization amongst ourselves, we could probably resolve some of these things internally.
Be careful when you're talking about performing an organization, because somebody in the back here will want to lobby for you, and that will cost you money.
She could be a relative of a testimony.
Testimony in favor of Senate Bill 291. We received notice from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, dated February 19th, 03, and received it. On February 28th. We don't get the mail every day. Requiring us to obtain a conditional use permit from Linn County before we could receive our annual license from ODFW. This notice came as great surprise to us, as we thought we had complied with all the requirements and even gone to the county planning personnel in January of 1995. We were told that our plans were a landowner privilege and no permit or further action on our part was required. As we need to plan a year in advance, we are now well into purchasing for the 2003-04 season before the notice was received. We've already purchased advertisement, insurance, contracted for birds and feed, as well as completed contracts with our hunters for the 2004 season. From our experience with county backlogs, we realized we could not possibly receive a conditional use permit and then apply for our license from ODFW in time for the opening of the 2003-04 season. As the funds derived from the hunting preserve are an integral portion of our income, we simply cannot pay bills or taxes if we do not operate our preserve. I'd like to add that we raise hay and Douglas fir, and we use hunting as an integral portion to balance out and make our place an economic unit. We directly provide employment for several people. We also purchase feed and bedding supplies and grain locally. We purchase chukar from a local business and utilize dog trainers and guides. Our small business is magnified through the local economy and does have a positive effect. In addition to the above, there is license sales and tax revenue generated for the county and state. Others in our business share our problems. We understand there are 32 other tax-paying hunting preserves who, like us, are in a sink or swim position. Thank you.
So, George, the grandfathering aspect of this legislation is very important to you, obviously.
The grandfathering aspect is extremely important to us.
Okay. Members' questions? Yes, Representative Work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, the buffer you spoke of, that's you're providing that buffer from your private land. Is that correct?
Yes, Representative Work.
Okay. And a point of clarification, yes. As I understand it, what the previous testimony spoke to is establishing a buffer not by giving up their own land, but by the person having the hunting preserve providing the buffer.
That's correct.
Okay.
Which it sounds like George does on his own.
Yes, we do.
Yeah. Okay.
Right, but I think how I understood the last testimony was that they're asking that we require the people going and setting up a new preserve to provide that buffer.
Yeah, that is my understanding of what the Underhills were asking for, and I think that's very correct. George, thanks. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Now, I know there's some other gentlemen back there. Would any of you like to come forward and say anything on this matter? We'd love to have your comments if you'd like. Feel free, sir. And if we would, for the record, tell us who you are.
I'm Keith Cyrus, and I won't get into when my ancestors come into Oregon, but some of them served in the legislature a good many years ago.
Uh-oh.
Maybe that's why we got the mess. But I'll make it very brief. I'm on the Deschutes County Planning Commission, just recently appointed. We got a lot of problems over there in that county, and one of them is that we don't even have provision for a shooting preserve such as we're looking at here, and that's why it's so critical to our continuing operation that we come in with the exemption grandfathered in. Our County Director of Planning reminded me how busy we're going to be with urban growth boundary expansions and all of that, and Ben Redmond and sisters, and we won't have time to deal with developing, changing the text amendment to even deal with this probably for a year, and then the process of making application for conditional use approval. And like the gentleman before me said, you know, we're well into plans for this next season. We raise our own birds. We're collecting eggs now. They'll be going incubator within the week, and you know, we're committed for feed and all this input, and our clientele that we've built up, worked at very hard, a lot of money advertising and such, you know, is at risk. So I support the effort and appreciate your efforts to move forward with this. Thank you.
Thank you, Keith. Members, questions? Hearing none, thank you very much. And with that, we're going to close a work session on this House bill. On House Chair, bill, yes.
Can I request that we...
Senate Bill 291. Yes, Representative.
Before the next hearing on this, that work session, that we get some clarification from the counties that denied the request for the...
I think that's entirely appropriate. If the Underhills could provide us with that documentation, or any other county that you're aware of that has what appears to be a misunderstanding. And I'd also like to talk to Senator Farioli, because I'm confused by his testimony. It seems that he is in error in his understanding of ODF&W's opportunity to require some of these issues, and so I'd like to have him clarify that too. So we will continue on at another day. Thank you all very much. Appreciate it. Good to have you here. Okay, we're going to open a work session on House Bill 3126. Representative Greg Smith is here. He has a -2 amendment. Representative? Now, Representative, our time is precious here.
I apologize, Chair Crump. Would you like me to...
Please, tell us what your -2 amendments do.
Sure. Again, for the record, I'm State Representative Greg Smith, representing District 57. Union, Wallowa, Umatilla, and Morrow counties. The -2s simply add the word gray wolf. On page 2, line 8, the last time we met, there was discussion about determining the procedures for the disposal of, and I inadvertently omitted gray wolf, not assuming that anyone would want to keep a gray wolf. what I do want to share with you just very, very quickly, and I know time is very limited, please understand where we started to where we are today. When we had our first public hearing in Wallowa County, we had comments such as ship them to Portland, put them in the Tillamook Forest, shoot the son of a guns, every comment you can imagine, to where we are today, which is we just want to protect our livestock, protect our families, and do it in a very legal and law-abiding way. Make sure that this is completely overseen by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, completely overseen by the Oregon State Police, and in the event that an incident ever does occur, that immediately both departments are notified. The last thing I want to point out, Chair Krupp, is the argument that I've heard in opposition to 3126. I want to put this out on the table. Is that we don't want to take the gray wolf off the endangered species list. But let me share with you. The feds introduced the gray wolf into the state of Idaho as an experiment. That experimental population has grown. The federal government has now delisted the gray wolf off of their endangered species list. We're doing nothing more than what the feds have already done. So I ask for your support on this. This is truly a compromise, I believe, in the greatest sense. Thank you, Chair Crop.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Members, questions? Hearing none, thank you. Glenn?
Anything to add? Okay. Is there anyone else here would be like to be invited by the chair? Hearing none. Representative Hunt, yes.
At least I had written down in my notes that ODFMW had said that they were going to review it and maybe get back to you by yesterday or get back to us today. I can't remember how that was left.
Well,
legal counsel.
I have heard from ODFMW regarding the governor's wishes on this subject, and I think any further comment from ODFMW regards to my question is probably not appropriate. But if they want to risk coming forward, Roy, you're darn, he almost made a clean getaway.
He's now on the endangered list.
Yeah, we're going to put Roy on the endangered list.
But we'll delist him next session.
Yeah, we promise.
Representative Hunt had a question. Being the finely attuned detail man that he is, Representative Hunt.
I believe last time you had said that you understandably hadn't had a chance to fully review the amendments at that point and to determine whether or not they dovetail with existing laws. And so I thought my memory is that you were going to go back and check with legal counsel from within the department. I just wanted to see what the outcome of that had been.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Hunt, we began our review with legal counsel on Tuesday afternoon and with internal staff. But then, of course, we do work for the governor, and we went and spoke to the governor's office about this amendment in particular. And Jim Myron then, after some time spent with the governor's office, I then relayed the message back to the chair and Representative Smith that the governor's position on the amendment or the bill had not changed, that the governor is not wanting to have any wolf legislation pass the House or Senate, that pass the Capitol this session. He felt that as far as the amendment went, that by adding the wolf onto the current wildlife damage statutes, it would cause confusion among some landowners, because here we have an animal that's both listed federally, listed by the state, now also allowed for damage statutes to apparently be taken. And the governor's office thought that would cause some real confusion about the law and about the wolf and status of wolves currently. And third of all, the governor's office wanted they felt that with the current commission, the Fish and Wildlife Commission, which is to proceed ahead and direct the Department of Fish and Wildlife to start planning through a process for a wolf management plan for the state of Oregon, the governor's office felt that in this planning process, we'll be able to deal with things like agricultural damage and wolves and the issues between the state and federal ESA. So for those three reasons, the governor's office wanted me to convey to the chair and Representative Smith, which I did yesterday late afternoon, that the governor would prefer that there be no wolf legislation this session.
And members, I, as the chair of this committee, offered to exchange wolves for bear and cougars with the governor's office, jokingly. Questions? Comments? Representative Worth?
I just want to be clear that there still is no verified existence of gray wolves in the state of Oregon.
Chair Krupp, Representative Worth, well, as we speak today, there is no verified wolves in Oregon that we are aware of. I guess verified, saying, does the department or state agency know of any gray wolves currently in the state? And the answer would be no.
You have, however, had three cases of straying wolves in Oregon from Idaho that have been verified, correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
And, but you know of none today that are here?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yes, Representative Worth.
Can you explain to me specifically what the Predator Control Program does?
Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, I'd like to call up Ron Anglin, our Wildlife Division Administrator, and he could give probably a better explanation than myself on those.
As you've heard from the previous bill, we are wanting to indulge people.
Chair Krupp, members of the committee, for the record, once again, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. Representative Wirth, predator control functions that our agency has is we contract with Wildlife Services and by statute contribute money to their budget, both through the Predatory Animal Control Fund and also through the Bear and Cougar Control Fund. And then they undertake control activities related to damage and related to human safety under our authority and by a written memorandum of understanding with the state of Oregon and with us.
So follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So if implementation of the proposed Bill 3126, would that would landowner now be eligible for compensation under the predator control program if they thought that this is due to gray wolf, even though there's no different real
Chair
gray
Krupp,
wolf in the state?
Chair Krupp, Representative Wirth, currently the state of Oregon has no compensation program for livestock losses or damages. So the state has no vehicle for any kind of compensation.
Oh.
Yes.
Well, what I'm interested in is we've just gotten the co-chair's budget, and I've noticed that predator control program got $0.4 million re-added back to it. So I'm wondering, is this for wolves? Is it for bear and cougars? What is it for?
Chair Krupp, Representative Wirth, I haven't seen that. I'm not sure if those figures are within our agency's budget or, in fact, within Department of Ag's budget. They also share responsibility, and you'd have to ask them about that portion of it and that portion of the funding. Our portion of the funding had not been removed from our agency's budget that we contribute to Department of Ag leading up through and including the governor's recommended budget. I haven't seen the co-chair's budget, so I don't know if that made any changes or not. But the funds that we contribute go directly towards predator control, which by statute is aimed towards coyotes, rodents, some birds, and specifically rabbits. And those are the species that, in general, Wildlife Services can deal with, and beavers also included on that Wildlife Services can deal with as part of our contract under the predator control.
Yes.
So, for ODF&W, what is your largest cost in predator control?
Chair Krupp, Representative Wirth, I'm not sure I understand your question.
What in terms of the predator control program, what is the highest cost for ODF&W?
Chair Krupp, Representative Wirth, we contribute a flat fee to Wildlife Services for predator control. They do that work for us just as part of their general program and in those counties where they're authorized to operate.
Okay.
Representative Wirth, I am not sure that I would be in agreement with you in reading this budget document that your interpretation is the same as mine. I'm reading this that there's been $400,000 removed from the Predator Control Program, and that there is the .40 on the far right is only the difference between the governor's budget and the co-chair's budget.
Right.
The co-chair's budget didn't eliminate any. The governor's budget does, and it remains to be seen whether there'll be any money that will go to the predator control program, correct?
It eliminated the governor's reduction.
Well, the narrative says eliminates general fund support for predator control program.
Right. And it eliminated that elimination. So that's the co-chairs didn't
restored
follow with
is
that.
The other word for eliminating the elimination. Yeah.
So I just was wondering what the cost was.
Okay.
Yes, Representative Hunt.
One more question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. You outlined several things that it sounds like the governor's office hopes to pursue. Looking at the intent of this bill as amended, or as about to be amended, what are the specific new authorities that the commission would have at your disposal that you or the department that you do not currently have?
Let me, Mr. Chair, perhaps address that and then maybe have Ron finish up the answer. But, Mr. Chair, Representative Hunt, we are currently working with Representative Jensen and the Chair on their House Bill 2458 to make some amendments to the State Endangered Species Act. And I think some of those changes would give us the authority, for instance, on personal safety and endangered species. In the Federal Endangered Species Act, there's a clause there that allows for personal protection that endangered species could be killed, taken, or captured for personal safety reason. That is currently not, for instance, in the State Endangered Species Act. One of our proposed changes, if we finish up this work for Representative Jensen and the Chair on their bill, House Bill 2458, would be to include that section in the state ESA. And there are some other things, too, I think, that when we're through and we've worked closely with the governor himself on these, on perhaps these changes, and we hope to have them ready for next week and bring them forward. But I think that would answer some of your concerns, sir, if you can see what we're working on right now with Representative Jensen.
Yes. And maybe that's the complete answer to. I mean, does this bill as amended give the department, give the commission any new authority to deal with this issue that you don't currently have?
And to answer that, Mr. Chair, Representative Hunt, I don't know if it does, because currently the list is on the wolf's on the federal list, and the wolf's also covered by the State Endangered Species Act. Now, one of the issues that we were going to work through before the governor's office stepped in and informed us to make sure that people knew they really weren't interested in any wolf bills was trying to figure out the conflict. Well, if it's on the state list but it's on the wildlife damage statute, what effect is that? Frankly, some initial advice would be the state list would still trump the wildlife damage statute, so you wouldn't really change the status of the wolf while it was still on the state list. And, of course, then the federal list, as long as it's on that, it trumps everybody. So the whole wolf issue, even in a legal sense, is very complex. And that, I think that's about the best answer I can give you on your question.
Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. Glenn.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Glenn Sumrink with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, and thank you for allowing me, because I wanted to kind of respond to some of the testimony. You know, the question is, are there any wolves? And we have documents we've provided with you that they're extinct from Oregon. But yet, we're going to expend taxpayer money for a wolf management plan. That's what the Fish and Wildlife Commission is doing presently. But they're not here. And yet we have them listed, but they're not here. All this bill, I see, will do, first of all, it will fall in line with the Federal Endangered Species Act, where they've been downlisted to threatened rather than endangered. In fact, I got an email yesterday that said that they're looking at very closely of delisting in the short term. So that's even going to make things work. But really what we're talking about in this bill, and I tried to think of a catchy phrase, but it gives the wolf the same constitutional rights that people have. Right now they have better rights than what people have, as I testified earlier. It's to protect our property and protect our family. I ask this committee to do what's right as legislators, and since it got brought up that the governor wants this or the governor wants that, I don't think our system was developed to say, well, we can only pass those bills that the government likes or doesn't like. He has an option at the point when the bill, if it arrives at his desk, to say, I'm going to veto this bill because, and then be answerable to the people whether they voted for him or not. But I think that responsibility falls on him at that time, but not at this level. Roy Elliker mentioned Representative Jensen's bill. I've been waiting for over 2 weeks to try to find out what those amendments are, because we've been have asked for a number of these wolf bills, and gee, if it solved our problem, we would just say we'll pull all the wolf bills. We still don't know what those amendments are and what they will do. So I urge you to go ahead and pass this bill. Send it on, and if those mystery amendments ever appear and they satisfy us, then, you know, we could certainly reconsider this and maybe over on the Senate side say, hey, that takes care of it. We don't have any more problem. But I would urge your consideration for passage of this bill. Thank you.
And Glenn, I'd like to state for the audience and the committee's benefit that if that were to occur, and the bill, and we had not passed the bill on the floor, and you were satisfied with the amendments in Representative Jensen and my bill, I'd be happy to pull this bill back into committee. That would be fine. I'd have no problem with that. Representative Beyer, you had a question.
As I've been listening to the discussion and the concerns about if there isn't a problem, why is Fish and Wildlife developing the plan? And I can't help but wonder if this plan is being developed by a push from us that there is an implied concern over the wolves, so they're trying to address it without having to go to this step. So it's kind of the chicken and the egg, who started what process, that I'm starting to wonder about. So
Representative, I thought we had had previous testimony that once you're listed under the Oregon Endangered Species Act, they have to develop a management plan. Am I incorrect about that?
Mr. Chair, that's what I've sat in on commission hearings when the Department of Justice has told the commission that, in fact, there was a policy by the ODF&W to ask the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to take back any wolves that strayed from their experimental population. The Attorney General's office tells the commission, wait a minute, that's contrary, because you have them listed as an endangered species on one hand. How can you be asking the federal government to take their wolf back on the other hand?
Mm-hmm. Ron,
so
come up in.
They're not in that mode right now. We're looking at, just for the same reason they're putting a management plan together in case they start coming here. We're looking for the same reason. In case they come here, we want some protection for our property and our family.
Yes. Isn't that the same goal, though? I mean, don't we get there regardless?
May I respond, Mr.
Please.
Representative Beyer. But we don't know what those are. Like I said, there's mystery amendments out there, and I don't know whether they're going to address our concerns or not at this point.
Ron, respond to, I know we went over that there were 27 or 29 species that were grandfathered in when the Oregon Endangered Species Act was adopted, but since then there have been some additions, and are those or aren't those not required to have management plans?
Chair Krupp, members of the committee, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. Our legal interpretation has been that those species that were grandfathered in prior to the 1995 or 1997 amendment are not required to develop a recovery or a conservation plan, actually, is the more correct term. Those species that have been listed since the amendments took place, we are required, and we have started doing that.
Yes, please.
And that, if I remember right, there is a list of 20, how many?
Chair Krupp, Representative Beyer, it's around 28, 29 species at this point in time.
Yes, please.
And I do remember the conversation being why, out of all those 27, why wolves? And what drove wolves to the top of the list? And I think that's where my concern is what did drive that there? Was it in ODF&W, or was it pressure from outside people driving it there?
Chair Krupp, Representative Beyer, we recognized as an agency with the three wolves that did show up into the state that as the population continued to grow in Idaho, we would continue to get wolves in Oregon. And we recognized that we did not have a very good way to deal with those animals as they came into the state, irrespective of what the federal status might be. And so we undertook a what's been a year-long process to educate our commission about wolves, bringing wolf expert into the state from all over the United States, bringing in representatives from the livestock industry. We tried to bring in a balanced set of people to provide comments to and educate our commission. Then we undertook the public process. And our commission, at the end of all that, decided that they wanted us to go ahead and move forward to develop the conservation strategies associated with wolves that we can do under the state ESA. And in those conservation strategies, then, it gives us the ability to define and take steps to match and meet some of the federal regulations that are listed within the recent downlisting in the 4D ruling. Without that, then we have a, in effect, more restrictive designation within Oregon and the state ESAs compared to the federal ESA.
Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So apart from the grandfathered species on the State Endangered Species Act, are there currently any species on our State Endangered Species Act without a management plan?
Chair Krupp, Representative Worth, I believe that the two most recent species were that have been added were the Washington ground squirrel and the Lower Columbia River coho, and we developed conservation strategies for both of those species.
Yes.
So there's no species on the current State Endangered Species Act without a management plan.
That were not grandfathered.
That were not grandfathered. Completed management plan, conservation plan.
Representative Krupp, or Chair Krupp, Representative Worth, to the best of my knowledge, that's correct. I think that there's only been a couple of species that have been listed since that was required, and we have immediately undertaken the action to do that. There's the big group of species that were grandfathered in that we have not undertaken that action.
Yes.
And what kind of discretion does the ODFNW have over over when these management plans are done, how much time is spent on them? What's your discretion over it?
Chair Krupp, Representative Worth, with the amendment to the state ESA, it sets out a pretty firm timeline that we have to have that completed in. And off the top of my head, I believe it's around 18 months. Somewhere in that, I'd have to look at the statute to get to exactly give that to you. But it's a fairly short timeline that we have to do that in.
Final thought?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And can you recall in recent history with those apart from the grandfathered in species, has there ever been such a proactive attempt to keep a management plan from happening as there is currently with the gray wolves, with the squirrel or whatever, the last couple species that were on the Endangered Species Act, or is this pretty much unique?
Chair Krupp, Representative Worth, I'm unaware of any actions like that. The only other active plan that we actually did was for the Columbian white-tailed deer, located down in Douglas County as part of the federal delisting process. And through the conservation plan that we worked with the federal government on developing, we actually were able to completely remove Columbian white-tailed deer from the state list and have been pushing the federal government, and we expect a complete delisting of Columbians by the federal government here fairly soon, and that which is what the goal of the whole state ESA is to get those species back off the list.
Okay,
Representative Hunt.
I think I just have one question, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Does this, if this bill were to be passed and signed into law, does that impact one way or the other whether or not you're going to expend dollars on this conservation plan? I mean, you've already, it sounds like you've already started down a road. Does this stop you or does this urge you on if this is signed into law?
Chair Krupp, Representative Hunt, it would have no impact on the conservation planning process.
I think, Representative, that would probably be a ways and means function that would have any influence on that at all. At all. Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Thank you all very much. Chair would entertain a motion. And could we find Representative Beyer?
Nope. Well, no, we cannot.
Representative Worth, we couldn't find Representative Beyer. I don't want her to miss an opportunity to vote on this bill unless she absolutely doesn't want to.
Do you want?
Yes.
Choose?
Yes, dash choose.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash two amendments to House Bill 3126.
Okay, members, Representative Smith has moved the dash two amendments to House Bill 3126. Discussion? Yes, Representative Worth.
I will be opposing these amendments that I've said over and over and over. A good friend of mine and a mentor, Tony Van Vliet, who used to be my former state representative, gave me some great words of advice, and he said over and over, don't make a bad bill better. And I, in my opinion, that's what these dash two amendments do, so I will be opposing it.
Hey, Representative Beyer.
Thank you. I'm going to be opposing this bill today. When we dealt with bears and cougars, I saw demonstrable need to deal with cougars, public safety, all those issues, a doubling of the population. I don't see three as a problem. Maybe when we've doubled that to six, come back and talk to me, and I might be a yes, but at this point, I just can't get there in this, so thank you.
Thank you, Representative. We are discussing the dash two amendments. Any further comments? Hearing none, would clerk call the roll on adopting the dash two amendments?
Representative Beyer.
No.
Representative Hunt.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Horst.
No.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Chair Krupp.
Aye. The dash two amendments are hereby adopted to House Bill 3126. Representative Smith.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the House Bill 3126 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Members, Representative Smith has moved House Bill 3126 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Nelson.
Oh, who is
that? No, that's fine. We're going to hear from everybody who wants to talk on this.
Okay. I just want to briefly say that. I have great respect for Governor Kulongoski, and however, there's only one perfect person who's ever lived, and thank God the rest of us can be imperfect. And in the last Agriculture Committee, we urged the state executive branch to pay attention to the fact we were going to have a horrific fire season. And the decision had already been made that, no, there wasn't going to be any additional money given, and it wasn't, and look what happened. So I'm just saying that, some of us, have to learn these things, and sometimes there are situations that we do change our mind about. So I'm going to bet on the good governor changing his mind because the danger, the damage, the loss of life or livestock is not something good to be on someone's conscience, and I don't want it on mine. And in Texas, we don't always know when a tornado's coming, but by dang, we prepare for it. And so I want to be sure that we're doing that in this state. And I love animals, and my vet told me when I was wondering about my little dog, he said, Donna, God made wolves, not dogs. And, however, dogs have been adjusted to gentler environments than wolves have in their current habitat. So we do have a danger, and I'll go with my vet.
Okay. Members, Representative Hunt.
I think one of the challenges we're facing on this bill and other bills is we've got a new governor who I'm convinced is going to be reasonable in wildlife policy, but I think that the challenge is we have such a short session, and I think the governor's office is not fully up and functioning because they're new. I don't particularly like this bill, and yet I think it's an improvement. I disagree with my colleague from Corvallis. I guess I think when we can make a bad bill better. That's an opportunity to try and get closer to something that, that may be better. I promised her, though, I'd never carry another minority report in, out of this committee.
Oh, my God.
So that being true, I am actually going to vote yes for this bill. I don't think it's quite there yet, and yet I don't sense that we're getting the kind of feedback, and maybe the governor's office just really isn't in the place yet where it can provide the kind of feedback that would get us to where this bill needs to be. I just think my general philosophy is preventive, whether that's I hate to see us wait until wolves are here, just like I hate to see us wait until class sizes are unbearably large. I think we need to take a more preventive, proactive strategy as a state, and perhaps this is one way to get there. I'm not sure, but I think Representative Smith has made a good faith effort to get there, so I'm going to support it today.
Thank you, Representative. Any further comments?
Oh, yeah.
Now, haven't you spoken once, Representative?
Two. Dash two.
Okay.
Okay. Just in case no one knows. there's no gray wolves in Oregon. In fact, we have more gray wolf bills than we do gray wolves in the state.
You're killing.
So it's I would say it's
verified.
There's more verified bills than there are wolves. It's most certainly, you know, our responsibility to manage the legislature, our time and resources, responsibly. And I think that there are much bigger and more important issues ahead of us and in front of us. And the less time we spend on something that doesn't exist, the more time we can get to the matters at hand. Budget.
Thank you, Representative. And the chair will have the final word on this issue. No, I guess he won't.
Well, I will let you have it.
Thank you. No, go ahead.
I just wanted to say again, I'm a no, and I won't subject you to my spiel.
Thank you. Anyone else before my spiel comes forth? All right. Members, I want to move this bill forward in the process. I said previously at this hearing on this particular bill that should we get the required amendments in the other legislation moving through the process that addresses the concerns, I think we're all pleased and would be happy to bring this bill back to committee or let it languish in the Senate. I think there is value, however, in moving this bill forward at the time because it, I think, provides an impetus for the governor's office to continue working with Representative Jensen on this particular issue that we've just discussed in terms of trying to meet the needs of the public safety aspect of this issue. The issue of spending money on a management plan is yet to be addressed and probably will be addressed in another committee. So with that, would clerk call the roll, please?
Representative Byer.
No.
Representative
Hunt. Aye.
Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Ward.
I don't care. No.
I'm sorry.
I don't really care.
Chair Clark.
Aye. House Bill 3126 is hereby passed to the full House with a due pass recommendation as amended to close the work session on this bill, thankfully. Well, and Representative Greg Smith will be the carrier of this legislation. We're going to open up a work session on House Bill 3252 regarding shellfish licenses. And, Ray, I understand that Representative Nelson has brought forward some amendments on House Bill 3252.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have not seen those amendments.
I believe they're coming to us as we speak.
There we go.
Thank you very much. Wow.
Mr.
This is a novel.
I think it's safe to say that the Dash 1 amendments replace the original measure.
Ray, I'm assuming that Representative Nelson and Matt will tell us exactly how much of the original measure replaces. Welcome, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Krupp, K-R-U-P-P. No, I'm fun to see that from this other side. And members of this distinguished and congenial committee, I want to thank you for your consent. And that's what we're asking for today. That's the same thing as friendly consent.
And in concurrence with the amendment to this bill, I brought a more proficient speaker with me today who will speak to these amendments. And I think they're exactly what you wanted. What we do know in this great state of Oregon is that recreation is very important. And as hard as we all work, as much as it rains and restricts a lot of the things that we do, that to have the opportunity to participate in various types of outdoor activities is very important. So with that said, I'd like to turn this over to Matt and let him talk to you about this win-win-win situation in the amendments of this bill.
Welcome, Mr. Chair.
And I am State Representative Donna Nelson, District 24. I forgot last time.
Thank you very much.
And
for
I'll go up
Matt,
here so I can see.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis, working with Bob Jacobson today. The Dash 1 amendments, I just got a copy of about an hour and a half ago, but they do address the issues that we tried to address here. Just briefly, I'll try and be quick. We did try to address the concerns, some of the concerns anyway, from the previous hearing that we had on the bill. First of all, the amendments clarify that we're only talking about marine shellfish. That would be that was important to us. Then it also changes the fees on the licensing. It goes to a $6 annual license for residents of the state. It would be a $20 non-resident license for a year. And then we also added a $6 daily license for non-residents. And this was one of the first things that we did to try and address some of the concerns with the small marinas that testified before, so that when people come in from out of state, they're not spending $20, they're only having to spend $6 on a daily license. And it's also important to realize that this bill exempts anyone under the age of 14 from having to have a license, whether they're in-state or out-of-state. And then lastly, what we did was all the money that's generated from this flows through the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and there it would be up to them to determine which department receives those funds, whether it be Department of Ag or State Police for enforcement. And then what we did was to allow Department of Fish and Wildlife to issue grants to marinas and ports across our state to help alleviate some of their concerns that they had with financial problems, to put some of this money back into the community to help with our economy. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, but we're hopeful that you would adopt the Dash 1 amendments and send the bill to Ways and Means.
Representative Worth.
I think, Mr. Chair, did you say grants just a minute ago?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, yes, I did.
Can
say
you
grants.
Elaborate on that?
Sure. The money flows to Department of Fish and Wildlife for the purposes of monitoring and taking care of our recreational shellfish across the state. Some of the money for that could be used to issue grants to marinas and ports, whether that be for record keeping, to help them, to help additional. When they came and testified, they were concerned about loss of revenue, and we're trying to help. If that actually does happen, we're trying to help replace some of that if it does occur.
And point of clarification,
yes.
We're talking just all this is fund, fee-based funds, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, yes. All the fees would go into one special fund at Department of Fish and Wildlife, and then they would disperse it from there.
Any additional questions? Hearing none, thank you, Matt. It should be noted, members, that with the co-chair's budget we received today, that on page 27, as I read it, unless Representative Worth wants to correct me, below the line, what might be added back is funding. There's a shellfish shift of funding from the general fund to a new fee of about $410,000. So apparently in the co-chair's budget, they've already built in the fact that they anticipate we're going to pass this bill and Ways and Means going to approve it. So what that tells me is that whatever little amount of money was going for shellfish is going away out of the general fund, and unfortunately brings the need for this, I guess, ever more prevalent. So, and that was a bit of a surprise to me.
Well, Mr. Chair, have we approved the budget yet?
No, we have not, as we've discussed previously. There probably will be a lot of discussion about that in the ensuing days. Matt, is there anyone else you're aware of who would like to testify here today?
Not that I'm aware of, Mr. Chair.
Sir, would you like to come forward, please? Feel free. Be happy to invite you, since this is sort of invited testimony day. Welcome, and for the record, state your name, please.
Hi, members of the
It's all right.
My name's Kelly Laviolette. I'm a part owner, operator of a marina jetty fishery with my parents, Shirley and John Laviolette, on the Halem Bay.
Yay.
And it's pretty intimidating, period, just being up here. So I'm trying to, we just kind of learned about this work session today. And so I was in, not to take too much of your time, but I was in Portland doing something else. My folks called me and had me get over here so I could at least be somebody representing us. You know, what my mom and dad said last time basically is the same thing. I mean, they'd address some of the, there's amendments. The licenses are $6 for the annual, $20 for the resident, and $6 for the non-resident. What about the surcharges as another?
Mr. Chair,
members of the committee, on all transactions that are issued on licenses, there's $1.50 licensing fee that would be added to that. So the $6 would become $7.50, the $20 would become $21.50. What's important to remember about that $1.50 that's added is 75 cents of it stays with the individual that fills out the license to help reimburse for their costs.
The retailer?
Yes.
The person selling them.
Additional income for the sale.
Right.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, but I think last time we mentioned, you know, that the 75 cents is, I mean, it's better than nothing. But and it's not that we want that revenue. We want the revenue from people going and enjoying the resource. And it's I mean, I just don't know where to begin. Like I said, I'm pretty intimidated by this whole thing. But the families are, I mean, everybody tosses around the $6 and a $7.50 figure like it's nothing. But when you talk families or German tourists or anybody, I mean, you're another $6.50 per person to go have one day of fun. If they're traveling from Canada to California, they stop in Oregon. Are they going to be buying these licenses? It takes a couple days usually to drive the whole Oregon coast. They're not going to be doing these things. So the revenue's lost. I mean, we're talking $410,000 what we're going to create. I wonder what the revenue's lost are going to be. And we keep comparing it to, I mean, I'm going all over the board here, but we keep comparing it to Washington has licenses and stuff like that, resource management. We've always been, if we're going to protect the resource, go to less limits, 6 crabs per person, no driving on the beaches to protect the clams. We, in 92, 93, when they allowed females, at our own marina, I can't speak for the other marinas, we allowed no females to be cooked at our facility. I mean, we're in it for the resource protection. I listened to some of the other people talking earlier, the ranchers and stuff, and their second or third generations. We've only been here 20 some years. We're newbies here, but I mean, we're really into what Oregon's all about. And for us, we see all these people coming here to see what Oregon's all about, and we don't want them to leave without paying something to the state for our resource. But it seems like they're a minuscule amount of people taking the resource. The commercial fisherman. I'm also a commercial crabber. We're at 13 million pounds of crabs this year. 13 million pounds. I mean, all the sport crabbers combined are the best we can come up with is less than 1 million pounds over a course of a year. And so our take is that, yeah, we'll have grants to help us sell the licenses and stuff like that. But a lot of people, it's already a sales job anyway, trying to talk them into going having fun. But now they're not going to have to pay a license to go have fun and catch nothing. And so instead of taking that $7.50, let's just take $7.50 four times for four family members and buy four crabs from the commercial fisherman who's already getting 13 million pounds of crab. And I don't know. I don't know if any of that made sense at all. I think I'm just rattling on, but I appreciate you listening to me.
Yes, Representative.
Tell me your name again.
Kelly Laviolette.
Kelly, I just want to tell you that when we worked on this bill, we worked on it on behalf of your parents.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm a little bit distraught right now to find out that, you know, that this is not something that they're happy about. And I have a hard time with saying, you know, understanding, well, let's just go spend, you know, $6 and go buy a crab when the whole purpose for going to crab is the recreation to begin with. It's not exactly that we can't go buy some, well, I buy artificial crab meat, but you know that we can't go buy crab just in case there's a stand alongside the highway. So I'm a little concerned about their concern. We tried to work it. We asked retail businesses what is the proper return on, you know, your investment to make it something worthwhile for you to be in business. And, you know, when we came up with these numbers and then half of the surcharge, you know, is that not correct, Matt? To make, you know, so anybody that gets, you know, 20% is pretty darn good. In our most of our businesses, if we make 5%, we're, you know, doing good. Some of us, if we make anything in aviation, we're doing great. But I'm just saying it's a recreation issue, so I don't know what else to do. We've given you the business. We've given you the money to make, you know, extra money.
Mm-hmm. Well,
we ask to make it win-win for you, so...
Well,
Representative, allow Kelly to respond to you, please.
What to do?
Representative Nelson, Chairman Croft, I don't know what to say either. I'm you know, it's just that where's the, I mean, for the fisheries, I mean, a lot of people behind this whole thing, lobbyists, which we have none of. I mean, we're just 13 little marinas. You see how many other ones are here today. And everybody's got to go fix the leak on their roof or do something else. And I try to emphasize the importance of being here to represent us. But, you know, I can only, the fish, you know, I lost my train of thought here, but, the fishing lobbyists, you know, they're behind the. They want another license, no big deal. People will spend the money to buy a license. Well, the crab license, it's going to go to a crab hatchery. Is there crab hatcheries that are going to benefit these crabs somehow, some way? Is there a clam hatchery that's going to benefit? I mean, usually a license fee is going towards the hatchery or something else. So here we have, and we're only catching a very small, minuscule amount. I mean, if we're so worried about that amount.
Kelly, Matt would like to offer a point.
Mr. Chair, if I could just make a couple of comments. As you had mentioned in the co-chair's budget, where it strips out most of the money dealing with shellfish, without any funds going to shellfish, we're going to have a recreation that's probably no longer going to be in existence for clams, for instance, where if there's no money to test for red tides and such like that, they're not going to be able to open a clamming season on our Oregon coast. So without any sort of revenue flowing to this, parts of our shellfishing industry could be shut down. And I think that's... I don't think anybody here wants that to happen.
Okay.
And also, if I could just comment, Mr. Chair, these fees are very similar to what the state of Washington already has. We tried to line them up to be very equivalent to them. We're actually a little bit under their fees. And I don't know of any smaller marina-type places that have gone out of business in Washington because of their licensing law. And here we're offering up some grant opportunities here, which I don't believe the state of Washington does either. But we're trying to help out these marinas and ports where necessary.
Mr. Chair, I might just mention this. One of the issues that was discussed was, you know, the overhead. Would there be an additional cost, you know, for a burden? And we found we already have in place, we already own the automotive system. You know, put your, you know, $10 in, get a ticket back, you know. So I don't know how further to streamline it to reduce, you know, the overhead to get you extra money. Uh-huh. But anyway, I was hoping it would be a win-win for y'all as well as for everybody
Concluding
else.
Comments, gentlemen? Anything?
Well, we keep saying Washington, and so we're going to bring up Washington, but they don't allow commercial bait dealers. I mean, commercial clamming for bait purposes. I'm also a commercial diver for bait and human consumption, and my own choice, I stopped using it for bait. But, you know, here we have the resource again. In Washington, Matt has said that Washington, the marinas in Washington, there is no other boat rental marinas in Washington. Like there is, it's a very unique, specific to Oregon only, just like our resource, where people can go and rent boats and do these kind of activities. So, and now this year we're having you have to get a boater's operation card for over 10 horsepower. So, once again, we're impacting it in that way, and that's the families, the slow economy, the war, everything else, and we're already getting the average people that go out and do these activities, and the $7, the $20, I just don't see how it's just going to... I know it's just me speaking for my little, small little business, but, you know, we're not... You know, you people stand up here and you're to see what happens at the coast for 5 or 6 months. It's like the ski resort or whatever else. When you have to start educating people on why there's a license or why there's a boat operating license, and it's definitely going to impact our business. One of my friends that has a marina, he has the automated system for licenses. I don't know how many times that thing is shut down, and that just shuts down the place. When you can't, when you have 6, 8, 10, 20 people waiting to go fishing and they can't buy a license, it's like, it's tremendous. I mean, you know, I mean, the frustration and everything else, and by the time that's fixed and remedied, I don't know.
Okay, thank you for your comments. Matt, anything further?
Mr. Chair, no, I don't think so. But I do realize it's late in the session. We would appreciate the Dash 1 amendments adopted so we can at least move it and continue working on it.
Ray, you want to tell us what the Dash 1 amendments do, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I've seen four principal points in Dash 1 amendments. The first is it establishes a marine shellfish license program. The second point is it specifies the use of the funds. Third, it creates a marine shellfish subaccount within the Department of Fish and Wildlife account. And the other point is that it establishes fees. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, those four points would require a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, not revenue. And we do have a subsequent referral by prior reference. This amendment would not change that subsequent referral.
Okay. So, Kelly and Matt, we will be moving this bill to the Ways and Means Committee, where you will additionally have an opportunity to come and testify and share your thoughts with the Ways and Means Subcommittee. So you'll have that opportunity. Thank you both very much. Appreciate it. The Chair would entertain a motion to adopt the Dash 1 amendments.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
I move we adopt the Dash 1 amendments.
Okay. Members, Representative Nelson has moved that we adopt the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3252. Comments?
I should quit looking this way.
Mr. Chair, we're real concerned at reading gray wolves in this bill, so this amendment. So
we're not offering any wolf amendments for the shellfish bill.
Oh, no.
Relating clauses aren't quite the same. Okay, hearing none, I'm assuming we have some no votes on the amendment, or... Okay, all right, would the clerk call the roll on the Dash 1 amendment?
Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Hunt.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
No.
Representative Orr.
Yes.
Representative Gilman.
No.
Chair Crum.
Aye. The Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3252 are hereby adopted.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move we move House Bill 3252. I lost my page here. 3252 to Ways and Means, is it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. As amended.
As amended.
With the due pass?
With a absolute due pass.
Members, it has been moved by Representative Nelson that we move House Bill 3252 as amended with a due pass recommendation to the Ways and Means Subcommittee. We have discussion.
Mr.
Representative
Chair?
Smith.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will be voting no. I'm very concerned about a tax of any kind on our small business people and the jobs that it's going to cost. And I've talked to many people who will no longer be able to go clamming or crabbing or doing the things that they've done and enjoyed as part of Oregon. So I will be voting no.
Okay. Representative Byer.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'm going to vote yes on this to get it down to the Ways and Means and let them sort all this out.
Okay. Representative, anyone else? The Chair would like to state that I do not share Representative Smith's views. I do not view this as a tax on small business. I think Matt made it very clear. It's obvious that we're losing the money for the programs that maintain the very health of the shellfish industry. And if we don't do that, we could entirely lose the shellfish industry. And that, I think, would be a far worse circumstance than any potential loss. I do not think there will be loss, in my judgment. And I will say this because I think this is an issue of folks do this for recreation. They don't do it to sustain their livelihood. In other words, they don't go crabbing and shellfish digging so that they can eat. They do it because they have disposable income. And I don't think requiring someone to spend $6 to use our resource and not help manage that resource is a bad thing. I would remind all of you that we require out-of-state fishing and hunting licenses when people from out-of-state use our resource. Why should this be any different, in my opinion? That is why I'm going to move this bill to Ways and Means. I do appreciate Representative Nelson's work on trying to address the issues of the individuals who did come and express their concern of any potential effect that might have there. I think it was very appropriate. I thank you for that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would just like to also state that, you know, things do happen. You know, I know a location in the state where there are numerous mill sites and that are dormant because they lost the business. And we've since, you know, provided them an avenue with state support to be reused for industrial purposes. So I don't think this is any different. Let's preserve economic development as recreation versus mills being used for something other than mills. So I just think it is a win-win for everyone. And I want to be sure that everybody knows I have no connection to the fishing lobby or fishing industry. In fact, I don't even know who they are. But I am a fisher and a crabber and a crabby.
Yes, Representative. Okay. Quick call the roll, please.
Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Hunt.
Aye.
Representative Nelson.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
No.
Representative Ward.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
No.
Chair Crump.
All right, House Bill 3252, as amended, is hereby passed to the Ways and Means Subcommittee with a due pass recommendation. We're going to close the work session on that, open a work session on House Bill 3549. Members, I have an amendment to this bill. It is my bill. It basically guts the bill and creates a agricultural task force of 13 members, and basically, what we're going to do is study this circumstance and this idea and concept during the interim. Given the budget considerations that we have, and Ray, does this have a supplemental scroll of Ways and Means?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it does. Are you speaking to the Dash 1 amendments, Mr. Chair?
I'm speaking to the Dash 2 amendments. Great. Which you probably don't have all of a sudden. Okay. Here's a copy of the Dash 2 amendments, and we probably ought to get them for everybody.
I'll go make copies if we hang out a couple of minutes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, members, what we're doing is instead of trying to address this issue now, we're going to basically study it during the interim and try to come to some understanding of what might be a good direction in this regard for the future. Probably it'll go to Ways and Means, and it may or may not survive as a task force. It may have to be downgraded to a work group, because usually it's a task force that has some fiscal attached, because you have the legislative body has to provide staff to it, and we may not have the money to do that. So, well, I guess I was talking to the wall. We're going to stand at ease for a moment.
Jeff, please.
Chair, while you're all looking over the dash to amendments, Chuck Craig, if you'd come forward, please.
I got to run upstairs.
Okay, that's fine. For the record, Mr. Craig.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Chuck Craig, Deputy Director, Department of Agriculture. Mr. Chair, we support the bill. We appreciate very much the earlier effort that you led on revising Oregon's lien laws. We think this could be an important complement to the support that the financial support against business failure that that provides for Oregon farmers and ranchers. And we will support your efforts however we can, including providing a facilitator again if that's what's called for.
All right. Thank you. Any questions? Hearing none, thank you, Chuck. Members, we are in work session on this bill.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I move the -2 amendments to 3549.
Members, Representative Gilman has moved the -2 amendments to House Bill 3549. Discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Oh, thank you. I just couldn't find the -2.
Oh,
thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very good. Any objections?
May I ask?
Yes.
I want to be sure there's nobody being paid on this task force.
Shouldn't be.
I want to be sure because we keep voting on all these
pitfalls. Reimbursement number.
Terrible.
Page 3, line 13.
It goes to Ways and Means. That's a question there.
And I'm happy to work that in Ways and Means. It says may be reimbursed for actual and necessary travel or other expenses incurred by them in the performance of their official duties. We may not be able to do that. It does give us the flexibility in that regard. And looking at the budget the way it is presented today, I kind of doubt if we'll have any opportunity to do that.
Because I would find it counterproductive.
Thank you, Representative. Any further discussion on the -2s? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Gilman?
Mr. Chair, I move 3549 as amended to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you very much. Any discussion? Any objection? So we're going to close a work session on House Bill 3549. Members, we have a quick meeting tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock regarding one bill that we somehow overlooked, a forestry bill, to get on the schedule. I want to hear that bill. If we can work it as a Department of Forestry bill.
We already had the hearing.
I don't think so.
Oh.
Or did we?
Yeah.
Okay, well, then we need to work the bill tomorrow morning, so that will be hopefully a fairly short meeting. I'll have to go back and look, but maybe you're right, Representative.
Did you say 9 or 9:30?
9 o'clock, I believe, is it posted at 9:30?
Yes.
David, is it posted at 9:30 tomorrow morning? It is. Okay, so it'll be 9:30, and hopefully we'll be very quick, and then we're going to continue some additional House bills on Tuesday that we simply have not, we don't have amendments for. We've gotten clearance from that, and we'll continue to work Senate bills. Hopefully we're going to be done within a two-week time frame with all of our bills. I would like to, we are intending to have a briefing from the U.S. Department of Agriculture in regards to the Farm Bill and how it affects Oregon, and ODA will be participating in that. We have a gentleman coming from Washington, D.C. to do that specifically for us. We are also hoping that maybe we can have a couple of other short hearings on a couple of other subjects that are important to us, and also perhaps maybe a field trip just east of town here, about 5 miles or so, or west of town, to see a methane generator at a dairy, Representative Gilman. Wow. So with that, thank you all very much. Great work today. And we're adjourned. Yes, Representative Nelson?
What time? Are we in session in the morning?